accession number 23447, reel 13.
Mr. Waller, reel 13. We were talking about your time in France with the 1st Battalion Rifle Brigade, and I wanted to ask, we were talking about the anti-tank platoon and how they had a minimal role, but you had some new ammunition. I know that's not directly connected, but could you talk about the Sabot ammunition?
The Sabot ammunition, yeah.
Sabot, sorry.
It was, the actual projectile was smaller and the charge larger, longer, and supposed to have far better penetrating facilities, but in fact we did use it at Villers-Vicarage on the Tigers, and there was no real effect there.
So that was it didn't work.
Not as far as the Tiger, mind you. That having said that, that was front on, which in addition to its heavy armour had one or two thick steel plates bolting on the front as well. So it was really not quite a fair.
So what's the next thing you remember? You moved to Tilly-sur-Sill.
Yeah, and there was quite a battle round there, I think, but with the Americans and the British.
And what do you remember of that? Or you weren't involved much?
We weren't really involved. We were on the outside almost, because it was an attacking battle, and anti-tank guns come more into their own in a defensive role.
So what happened next then?
We were then, after that, we were moved back again towards Caen, round about Caen, where they were still trying to make the breakthrough.
Were you under the Canadians then? Was that?
That was shortly afterwards we went under the Canadians.
Okay.
But at Caen, we witnessed the 1,000 bomber raid that came over. It was quite boring spot.
What was it like to see that?
Tremendous, you know. The sky was absolutely filled with almost 1,000 planes coming over, and got towards the city, and then they dropped their bombs. One felt almost sorry for the German troops with that lot coming down, although from later reports I gather that they'd withdrawn, and it certainly did damage on Caen. I think it did as much damage to the civilian population of Caen as it did on the German troops. So, but then after that, still no breakthrough, we were given the task of going more on the towards the coastal sector to seek and attack the V1s. The rocket sites, because they were easily put up and easily dispatched, and as majority of our people were Londoners, many of whom had suffered from the bombing, you know, as the old saying goes, they bombed my grandma's home, and they felt that it was an ideal opportunity for us to get our own back, and we would do it with great relish. So after that, let me see, was it...
What happened during that? Do you recall?
Well, we went along, there again, it was the carriers that came into a large part, because they were fast moving along, and, you know, when they saw these sites, they used to go in and they had 0.5 Brownies mounted on the carriers by then, and it was like a general shoot-up of, as soon as you found one, you went in and sort of have a general shoot-up, and then the REs would go in and place charges on the sites to demolish them.
And one thing that's in your thing is you came under Nebelwerfer for fire. I don't know when that was. It's not quite clear from you remember what you think.
Yes. Now there I've got to think just where. It was in... We were moving up... I'm trying to think of the name of the villages. There were a number of villages that we were, I think it was Cornwall and other villages that we were attacking. And they, in one of the villages, they were dug in there. And then that was the first experience we had of these.
What was it like coming under Nibbleworth?
Well, the noise itself frightened the life out of you. It was horrifying, you know, all the things coming over. And then, of course, about 8 or 10 of them burst in within a small area. And I lost quite a good friend then, Corporal Baker, and he got killed. And it was generally, we were pinned down by them. We sort of couldn't make any headway. They were obviously well dug in and well sighted. So, and this was a general pattern of coming against. You know, you move from one village to the other, and they were most probably fortify the village and dig in. And
now, were you mostly still with the anti-tank, or were you detached to the infantry?
Oh yeah, we were still with the anti-tank. You know, I mean. Because when they fortified a village, quite often they had, you know, might have a limited number, might be a couple or four tanks, you know, hidden in between or in the buildings and were waiting. So you needed the anti-tank guns in case they launched a counter-attack. But this very rarely happened, and I say we were. It was the. Really, the odd shots here and there that we were firing, you know, where we saw a target and fired it, that the brunt, as I said earlier, always fell upon the infantry and the carriers. So,
what's the next thing you remember?
Pardon?
What's the next thing you remember?
Now, was that, I'm trying to remember when Operation Goodwood started.
That would be about July the 18th.
Yeah. I remember we were advancing in France, and just whether that was the operation or earlier, we were advancing through the cornfields, and we were getting shelled pretty heavily. And I can remember that was when my friend Bill Ash, who we'd been together in the desert, Italy, and when I say together, either on the same gun or the adjoining guns when we got split up. That was when he got wounded. His half track got hit going through the cornfields, and I always remember that the ambulance. I saw an ambulance came up, and somebody came rushing across and said, "Bill wants you. Come quick. He's been hit." And I thought it was a sort of last rites to say goodbye. Anyway, when I got there, he's laying on a stretcher, and it was a Canadian ambulance, and I said, "For God's sake, find out what he wants, because he won't get let us put him on the ambulance." I said, "What's the matter, Bill?" He said, "I want my loot box." And he had a little German ammunition box, and he said, keep all his souvenirs and other bits, of watches that he traded or anything. And I said, "Where is it?" He said, "On the truck." And I said, "Well, the damn thing's on fire." He said, "Oh, you can nip in there, all right, and get it for me." And I said, he said, "I'm not going to get it." So I had no option. I got on this damn thing, got his box off and gave it to him, and he happily clutched it on his chest, and they put him in the ambulance and took him away. And that was the last I saw of him until two or three years after the war, you know.
And you're not sure which attack that was in?
Well, that would have been Epsom. That would have been the first one.
Back end of June?
Yeah.
And what do you remember of Operation Epsom? Other
than that, moving forward and remembering you get a lot of the tanks getting knocked out, and came under heavy shell fire, presumably 88s, but because it was very accurate, so it wasn't indirect fire, you know. Well, you know, lobbing, it was direct fire as it would come from an 88, so the way it was picking the tanks and the vehicles off. It was a bit chaotic, you know. All you know, it was going on all round you. You were getting shelled and everything else, and eventually you're on the move, and you get to the point that you were aiming for, or got stopped and got called to a halt. You know.
What's the next thing you remember?
Now, where did we go from there? We'd been under control of the Canadians. We then came back to the British Army. Our route was moving up through France, taking on through the various villages.
It sounds like the attack was Goodwood, because yeah. They didn't move forward for nearly 2 months after Epsom.
Yeah.
So it sounds a bit more like Goodwood.
Yeah, could have been, I say.
So you're talking now about the breakout towards the Falaise Gap, are you?
Yeah.
What do you remember of that?
Well, we weren't, when I say we weren't directly involved, we were pushing up, but it was the Poles and others that went round the side and started shelling into the pocket. So we were pushing from the rear, as it were, pushing them, and they were withdrawing through Falaise, and the Poles and the others were on either side shelling them. I think anyone that went through there would tell you the description. The place was absolutely littered with them.
Which place, sorry?
Well, around the what we call Falaise.
What was it like?
Well, I mean, there were trucks and bodies and dead horses, everything. I mean, everything had just been smashed because there was no way out, and they were virtually getting fired at from three sides, and they couldn't get out quick enough because the Germans were still using a lot of horse transport to get their troops away, and the tanks broke out. They couldn't quite close it off. The German armour got through. They a lot of them got away, but they lost quite a lot, and they lost obviously tremendous casualties amongst the ordinary infantry and stuff like that. And but it was there again. We weren't being used to fire there because they were using the 25 pounders and the tanks and all of which were using high explosive to fire it into the withdrawing troops. And then, once again, it was more or less came to a conclusion, and we were moving on again.
Because then there was a fast advance, wasn't there, right through to Brussels and
yeah,
beyond.
Yeah.
What do you remember of that bit?
Well, as you say, it was you struck light opposition on the way. But that was our next move. We moved through towards Brussels and then up to Ghent.
What sort of reception were you getting from the local French and the Belgians?
Very good reception. You know, everybody running out and all the young ladies throwing flowers and throwing their arms around your neck. And so
any difference between the Belgians and the French, or, you know, in attitude?
Well, I think if anything, the Belgians were more enthusiastic. More hospitable, and when we got to Ghent, we were the first ones to get into Ghent, and there is, if it's still there, there was a plaque with the Desert Rat sign pinned on the town hall, and as far as I know, it's still there today. But we got in there, and we were billeted with civilians, and the local Mackie were dragging out all the so-called collaborators, mainly the women that had been friendly with the Germans and that, and sitting them down in the square and shaving their hair off, and they were jeering and wailing, and wasn't very pleasant.
How did you feel about that?
Not too happy, frankly, personally, and one or two of my friends didn't. We thought, well, you know, these things happen. It's very difficult to judge when you've never had your country occupied. And we felt, well, if they wanted to do something, I mean, they should have dealt with it we were terribly British. We felt it should have been done in a normal legal way with a trial, a tribunal, rather than sort of drag them out in the square. But then I suppose that once it was over and their hair grew again, you know, I'd probably forgotten about. Whereas if they'd had a trial and they'd been found guilty, they might have been languishing in prison for a while. But these things happen in war, I'm afraid.
How long were you in Ghent in the billets?
Oh, just a few days, and then there was news came through, and they said, "Oh, some German armour had broken through outside Ghent, you know, some way outside." And then we had to move out to counteract it if it looked like moving forward. But in fact, whether they changed direction or decided not to advance any farther. I don't know, but it didn't result in any action from there.
And what do you remember next?
I think it was all round about that time. I think that was when they started giving 48 hours leave into Brussels. And I and one or two of my colleagues got leave, and we had a 48 hours in Brussels.
What do you remember of that?
A dazed recollection. We spent all our time whining, dining, and looking around. And I remember we was a damn good pub crawl and bar crawl. One or two went off and found obliging ladies, and I went round looking for some sort of souvenir in a shop in Brussels and bought a wristlet chain with, you know, these little shields on of all the different Belgian provinces, so there was, everything hadn't been looted by the Germans. So, and I remember I bought that and sent it home to my wife, you know. So, and then it was a brief 48 hours and back to the grindstone again.
And the next thing, you moved into Holland.
Yeah.
Well, Netherlands, on 24th September, it says here.
Yeah.
What happened when you got into... you seem to have gone to Dinther and Heeswijk. Oh, I don't know how to pronounce them. You went to Dinther and Heeswijk, according to this. But what do you remember, anyway?
Well, in Holland, that's right. We were moving through. There wasn't much action going on. It was mainly a pursuit. And I remember one place we stopped at in Holland, where we stayed there, and a bit of a surly old chap he seemed when we got billeted on him. But he seemed to melt a bit and started telling us that this windmill that he had was 400 years old, and suddenly produced some postcards and wrote on the back and signed them, and he seemed quite normal then. He sort of got over the fact he'd obviously been left alone during the war, and he didn't like the idea of suddenly a battalion of troops descending upon him and sleeping in his house and his barn. So, and gradually we moved up to I'm groping for the name.
Overloon?
Yes, we were over... Oh, that... Yes, that was about the first one, Overloon. There was... That was in the forest there. There was a big forest, and there was... We got quite involved in quite a battle there.
Do you remember of that?
Well, it was a ghastly sort of place, you know, sort of... you didn't really see anything, fleeting glimpses in the forest, and you were almost firing at shadows. But there again, ideal infantry country, you know, and
no good for you again.
No, you get word, oh, tanks coming so and so, and you might as well, and you get off a few shots, and then they'd either back away or something like that, and as I say, Europe was definitely infantry country, you know, because of the type of country it was, you know, very close. But then we moved into it was near Geleen, I think, with the place. I think the photographs there show the sort of leave I had.
No, that was in October. Yeah. Actually, yeah. What do you remember next then? What happened?
We moved up. It was when winter came, it was a very harsh winter.
Where were you then?
I don't know. Did it mention it there?
Did it mention a place?
Yeah, we got towards. We were at this. I'm trying to remember the name of the place. We were in a Dutch village on the German border.
That'll do, yeah.
And it was a static position, and we were sending patrols out into Germany and coming back. And this would have been in the November December time, because we spent the Christmas there. We were billeted. Well, when I say billeted, we took over one room as an HQ for the wireless this farmhouse, it was an ordinary house, but we took over one room, and there was the Dutchman and his daughter. He had one older daughter, she would have been about 18, I think, at the time, and two younger ones, around about between 6 and 8, and the mother was expecting again, so we used to help provide whatever we could, you know, towards their supplement, their rations. And the children, I always remember they asked me if I would draw them a picture of Father Christmas, which I drew an English Father Christmas, and they looked completely bewildered. And the eldest daughter, who could had taken English at school, explained that it was St. Nicholas over there, and so I then was educating how to draw a picture of St. Nicholas rather than Father Christmas. And then they told us about the custom of beforehand, how you drop sweets on the stairs and things like that prior to Christmas Day. So that's when the compo rations came in very handy. You had this big tin of boiled sweets over. We used to drop them down, and we tried to use that sort of thing as Christmas presents for the youngsters.
And this was in the Bourne area, it looks to me like.
Bourne, that's it. Bourne, County Limburg.
B-O-R-N.
Yeah, Bourne, County Limburg. And it was a mining area, because I remember that, because we used to go to a town nearby and go into the pit head bowls there to get showers. So must have been about 15 miles away, and he was going by truck.
What were they like, the showers?
Oh, quite good. I mean, they were pit head showers, the same as you would get them in the mines over here, you know.
How often would you go?
Oh, I think once a week, once a fortnight, you know. So many of you.
Was that your only real chance to get a proper bath?
Yeah, yes. bath was a luxury, you know. One of the few times I can remember, the other time being, they said, was at Bayer, in the early days when they set up a mobile bath unit there, but that was the previous one I can remember. So.
One thing, you seem to have got a lot of propaganda.
When we were born, you see, I don't know whether they thought we were American troops or what, but the Germans were firing these leaflet shells over, and they were coming down over us, but most of them were related to the American troops, so either they misdirected their fire or their intelligence reports as to who was occupying the positions was rather adrift.
What did you think of them when you looked at? I mean, you've got some examples.
But yeah.
What did you think they were any good or?
No, we didn't take much notice, you know. Giggle and right. Let's collect them as souvenirs, you know.
So, did anything happen while you were at Bourne, or was it just a sort of quiet period for you?
Well, not as far as only patrol work and the positions occasionally.
Did you go on any of the patrols to help out the infantry?
No. Not there. I can remember staying, getting a number of guards. In other words, that was our contribution. We were doing guard on different areas. And you had everything on. Long johns, battle dress, sweaters, pull-up overcoats. And you still froze and you huddled there. And the greatest thing was, when it was, you were relieved of somebody coming out with a mug of hot tea with some rum in it, and you felt the ice crackle within your veins. And but that was a reasonably pleasant period, because we were held back towards platoon HQ. The anti-tank guns were held back towards platoon HQ. They didn't sort of dig them in the defense. It was mainly the infantry once again, and the patrol work. And I think we had a word with the infantry and said, well, when you go out and patrol in Germany, if you can pick up any bedding for this far advanced pregnant woman, it would be greatly appreciated. So they used to come in with various bits that they gathered from their patrols.
So what happened next? So were you involved in the Ardennes matter, or, you know, the German Ardennes offensive?
Yeah.
Did they catch you up in that?
No, well, not directly. We got news of what was happening, and we were told that the division, in fact, I think the whole of 30 Corps, were going to make our way to the River Meuse and dig in there, and that was going to be, they couldn't stop them before, we were to hold them at the River Meuse. It was more an American.
Did you actually go to the Meuse, or was it just a warning?
No, we made our way over towards it, but we didn't finally get there. We were within striking distance, because the thing I can remember about the Ardennes, about the Bold, was when we were at Bourne, it was on New Year's Day, and we looked out and we thought, what the hell is that? And we saw the first German jet fighters in the sky. We were a bit puzzled. We hadn't realised that that's what they were. Nobody had told us they had jet fighters.
Were you impressed by them?
Well, the speed of moving, yes. But they were only passing over. They weren't. There were no dogfights going on. But I can remember that was the first time we ever saw a jet fighter in. And it would be, I think, New Year's Day, something like that.
And you were already on the move then, or were you still at Bourne?
No, we were still at Bourne. Yeah. So you moved off
to the Meuse in January.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So. That would have been between Christmas and the New Year that we saw these, when the German offensive had started.
So when you moved towards the Meuse, what happened then?
Well, on the move, then the thing I can remember was that we were moving towards it. We weren't being engaged in anything. And then gradually the news came through, that the German attack had been stopped. Thank you.